all the time you lose in introductions. You know, if somebody were really famous or really good, like they just say, ladies and gentlemen, the queen. That's all they say. They don't have to go through all of this. And okay, well, I have just a few of a cursory statements to make before I begin. They use the word exegetical. There are 45 verses here. And I think S. Lewis Johnson said something in the nature of 135 fulfilled prophecies. I'm not exactly sure how he gets to that number, but there are many. You've looked at it for sure. Some of you have done more work on this perhaps than me, so I want for you to pray for me throughout. I think I moved from exegetical because then I was encouraged to make it sermony, because somehow this will end up with the others in the tape thing. I think I've aimed for relevance. You think maybe that would be okay? I want to really rush, as it were, to try to get to the end so that I want to, at the end, make this something that is relevant for us. I had at first started out wanting to take us through apocalyptic literature, which is a new genre being birthed at this period in Israel's life. And I do want to say a word about how secularists treat apocalyptic in general, and when they come to a book like this one in Hebrew literature, in the Old Testament canon, they do not treat it any differently. And I do feel that we need to be prepared to dialogue with them. I understand it is enough to say that Jesus accepted the book as canonical, and that's good enough for me. But I think that we need to be prepared to engage them in dialogue them on their turf in this area, and it can be done. And I wanted to spend some time about that, and also with redaction criticism and such, and how we could incorporate that kind of thing. But I've decided, because of the time, to chuck all of that. And at some point, I'm going to actually bypass the early dating of Daniel and defer you to Gleason Archer. With all of those cuts in mind, we may get to the end. That's my goal, and I'm sticking with it here. Okay, I want to start by saying that the purpose of apocalyptic literature, the meaning of it, is the unveiling. And it is virtually someone going back and pulling the curtain on the future in a way, perhaps, that goes well beyond the prophets. So the meaning of it is unveiling. Secondly, it is a track for bad times. Some have moved beyond that and called it a track for crises, and I agree with that as well. The phrase that is recurrent in my free translation throughout Daniel is, what God is going to save you now, buddy? That's the kind of thing, that the flavor that just permeates the book of Daniel. So it is really a track for bad or hard times. Apocalyptic also features the sovereignty of God. Do you all have an outline that I have passed out? I'm not really an outline person. My wife says they're very good, though, because they give you an idea of when I'm going to be done. She says, so if there's no other reason, I always encourage people to just sit and listen. If you want to take notes, that's fine. But anyway, one of the idiosyncrasies or the hallmarks of apocalyptic literature, and there are many, is that it features the sovereignty of God, and boy, that has already been demonstrated in just the few sessions we've had in Daniel. Let me say, however, that in apocalyptic, the future is fixed in a way that I think goes beyond prophetic literature. I mean, it's true about prophetic literature as well, like in the book of Jonah. Jonah comes in and he keeps preaching 40 days and then the judgment, right? How would you like? That's a pretty simple sermon to preach. And the interesting thing is, if a prophet doesn't preach what comes true in the near future, what are we supposed to do to him? We're supposed to stone him. And God didn't bring the judgment on them. Why didn't they stone Jonah? Now, I mean, I think they ought to have stoned Jonah for other reasons. But not for that. Because what is implied in the book of Jonah, and the reason Jonah is so feisty to begin with, is because he knows God. And that's one of the emphases of the book of Daniel. Do you know God? Do you truly know him? We're not talking just salvation here. We're talking know God. Isn't that what Paul said? I want to know God. And that's the idea, is to move toward this sovereign God in a way, and I will try to bring this out at the end, that we end up really knowing him. Okay, now, I bypassed all that stuff. I want to get now to the fascinating thing about apocalyptic is this potential upon the profound sovereignty of God. Apocalyptic literature, and Daniel is one of the first, literally gives the future as fixed. And its emphasis is to give a boost of the Holy Spirit, as it were, as if it were a shot of adrenaline. For the apocalyptic, the future is so fixed, it is unchangeable. For him, it is just as unchangeable as the past. Can't go back and redo that. So if Daniel is to fall into that frame of literature, we'd expect to see something of that, and that is, in fact, what we do see. Point I'm trying to make here is that prophetic literature certainly has prophecies. The gist of it leaves room for response from humans. Apocalyptic literature doesn't seem to do much of that. And one of the characteristics of apocalyptic literature is that angels give it. And so it's almost like this comes from the top. Do you have your security clearance kind of a thing? I would say that in regard to this, then, that it is for Jews in the ancient Near East in the midst of a fierce anti-Semitism. Now, as it relates to dating other apocalyptics, let's move on in the scale, I think, to page 3, the top of page 3. Dating Daniel and the other apocalyptics, so far as the secular apocalyptics are concerned, they were very much like their pseudepigraphic brethren. And in fact, let me just move from these notes here. The usual technique in dating apocalyptic literature is that we read it until we find an error. And when the error is found, that's when they date the apocalyptic. Because the apocalyptic, of course, goes back and he writes the future. He writes history as if it's future. You understand that? That's what you find in other apocalyptics. So the secularists treat all apocalyptic literature like that. And when they come to Daniel, they treat him the same way. So when they come to chapter 11 in this mindset, they get to verse 40. And when we are emerging into this character of Antiochus Epiphanes IV, he becomes the antitype of the future Antichrist. I would argue that when we get to verse 40, there is a merging that takes place. They say it's an error. I would agree that it goes beyond who Antiochus was, what we now know about him, but I would never call it an error. I would say that they are not hooked into the mindset of the living God in this new genre of literatures. So let's go to wars and rumors of wars, beginning in this text at verse 2 through 4. By the way, if I were preaching this in my church, though I do make people stand for long readings, and I wouldn't be averse to having them stand for 45 verses at all, in this case, with the difficulty here, and when you're speaking of exegesis, there are a lot of arguments back and forth of a certain verse. We would never have the time to do that, much less even read this text. I never preach without reading the whole text. But, man, we just can't today. But at verse 2 through 4, Daniel is shown, as he is in the two preceding chapters, as well as the statue that we have seen, he is shown the future in these empires. And in 2 through 3, it's the future of the Persian Empire. And here the angel takes up a familiar type of speech by listing three kings followed by a fourth. He uses the same approach all the way throughout the text, the four divisions of four. Each are given in the preceding visions then, And the fact that Cyrus is the king when he's been given this mention means that there are three that are going to follow. We believe they are Cambyses, Smerdis, and Darius Hystaspes. The fourth one needs to be Xerxes, who is then the Ahasuerus and husband of Esther in the book of Esther, which means that the angel has edited out a king. But that was the way they did their accounting. It should not be a problem to us. That kind of thing is done in the genealogies all the time because of their fascination on numerical balance and such. But the point I want to make is that ending with Xerxes is important for Daniel because Xerxes is the one who attacked and infuriated the beehive of Greece. And he crossed the Hellespont, he went and engaged Greece in the Battle of Salamis in 480 BC, and through that, he began a conflict that would ultimately lead to the downfall of the Persian Empire. Even though the retaliatory attack by Alexander did not occur for 150 years, and he came on the scene, the angel here, I believe, uses Xerxes' offense as the foundation for introducing Alexander the Great in verse 3. It is, I think, the same way in which modern critics on the left of our political horizon try to argue that George Bush came into the office with a chip on his shoulder because they argue he wanted to finish something his father started and couldn't finish. You understand the argument. Now, in George Bush's case, I'm not casting I don't know what was in his heart. But in this case, I think you can take it to the market. The text says in verses 3 and 4, "Then a mighty king will appear who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out for the four winds of heaven. But it won't go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others." Now, of course, the angel is now making reference to none other than the rise of Alexander the Great here, who appeared as a flash, albeit an explosive one, 334 BC. And he is tantamount, even though he was 30 and he reigned some 13 years, still he was a military and administrative genius. The army he amassed conquered no less than 11,000 miles of land. You can look at the map here, I think. Do we have that? There we go. It was an incredible victory. I'm sure you know all of this. He became unarguably the ruler of the known ancient world. And while he is said to have sat and cried because there were no more lands to conquer, the truth of the matter is probably that his men just refused to go any farther. But either way, he contracted some unknown disease. He dies at the age of 32. And in that alone, I would argue that there is something mysterious about this apocalyptic tractate because the writer is showing marked restraint in rendering to Alexander only two verses. I believe there may be a subtle message in that because it was God's way through the angel of asking the question, what would it profit a person to gain the whole world and then lose his soul? In any case, the later part of verse 4 points out that his place at his position was not in fact inherited, as a first listener might have well expected in this piece. Although Alexander had two sons, one was illegitimate and the other unborn, the illegitimate one was handicapped, it really didn't matter. Both of them with his wife were assassinated shortly after the birth of the second child and his death. And the kingdom was divided into four quarters, one for each of the four strongest generals, who were namely Antipater, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucid. And for the sake of this morning, and even in the spirit of this prophecy, we need to focus our attention on only two of them, the two strongest ones, and the two who eventually eliminated through field skirmishes the other two, but could not eliminate each other. They were the Ptolemy and the Seleucid dynasties. Ptolemy in the south in Egypt and Seleucid in the north. And I use the word dynasty because verses 6 through 20 are going to cover continued battles over these two dynasties throughout the next 150 years. Notice with me in this new map, as they fought, the land and the people become the football field in the middle. The interesting thing is that these 14 verses, coupled with the bookend verses that are surrounding them, contribute to make Daniel the most comprehensively predictive chapter in the entire canon of scriptures. In fact, the chapter itself incites modern-day critics. It provokes them in the same way that I believe Xerxes provoked Greece in his attack, because it provokes modern-day critics with its minutiae of detailed events, like political marriages, launching a battle here and one there that otherwise wouldn't have received any merit or shouldn't have deserved it. That all of these seemingly have no interest in bearing on anyone except the most eccentric historian. Or it seems, as I'll point out at the end. And yet these prophecies are so accurate that we can find a fulfillment for each one of these. And I've tried to just put generic ones on the most important cases as we move down through the text. But again, and for the sake of time this morning, let me draw your attention to verse 21. Because a significant transition occurs at chapter 21, which is what I would call the second significant section of the chapter, and for me would start then a new sermon. It is the accession to the throne of Antiochus IV Epiphanes, 175 B.C. there in verse 21. I would submit to you that he is the little horn of the third empire of chapter 8, but is the little horn of the fourth or Roman empire in the beast of chapter 7. But in both of these cases, and by the way, I think that's important to notice the difference in the little horn in both empires, and I'll try to draw that out a little bit later. He is repeatedly described by Daniel as the contemptible person that no one would have taken seriously because he had no legitimate right to the throne. He names himself Antiochus Epiphanes IV, which is God manifest. Now, there were a lot of kings doing that, so we're not going to indict him for that as exceptional. So there were a lot of other people doing that, but he was a crazy, to be sure. Because of his craziness, they actually played around with the name and nicknamed him Antiochus Epimenes, or madman. Polybius, as early as Polybius, he tells us that in his histories. There are brief stories that abound here. He used to go around shaking hands with mothers as if he were running for election. He would kiss their babies. He would dress up and march in parades, and his Secret Service people would go crazy. They would find him in the pubs drinking with the commoners and telling coarse jokes. One time someone said to him, one of his friends, it must be nice to be nobility and being anointed with oil all the time. The next day at the gymnasium, he had a complete barrel of oil rigged up, and when the guy walked through the door, it drenched him. So for military people, like our generals in the army and such, he was one of them. He was a good old boy at heart. But later he would break the covenant and he would throw those same mothers with their babies tied around their necks from the walls. And all we have to do is read the accounts in the Maccabees for that. As it relates to his effect upon Judea, which is the next stage, under the first years of Antiochus's reign around 170 BC, he began to eliminate religious leadership, verse 22. He replaced the high priest Onias III with Jason, who even had a Gentile name, and finally Menelaus when he was killed. I believe Onias is the prince of the covenant there in verse 22. By the way, I always at my church recommend that people take my point of view. Do you do that? In this prestigious group, I'm not sure you will. Don't beat up on me. I think you should take my point of view, but in the end, we'll see what happens. Even though Antiochus himself didn't kill this guy, in essence, he did. And it's interesting, his father had issued an epistle of peace during this time that was referred to as a time of security. I think it appears in verse 21 and 24. In fact, his father before him had actually participated in the sacrifices. He even gave money to Israel to repair the temple. And I say this because the political environment, and I'm going to draw some conclusions when I get to the end, the political environment was such that Israel was attracted to him in the beginning. In his first Egyptian campaign, verses 25 through 28, 169 BC, Daniel saw a deluge of battles, with Israel being that football field in the middle. Facts are, we really aren't certain historically whether or not Antiochus actually invaded Egypt two or three times. Daniel seems to believe that it was two, but the significant encounter occurred on the day of Eleusis, verses 29 and 30, 168 BC. What happened here is he was coming back from an Egyptian campaign, and the ships of Kittim, which is referred to in the Old Testament at different places, I believe the Roman Empire, confronted him because Antiochus was getting too big for his britches. And they stopped him at this place called Eleusis. And the general Gaius Populus Laenas confronted him and told him to back off and settle down. Antiochus tried to compose himself because he was a madman. He knew he was outnumbered, and he tried to get out of it politically by saying he would confer with his generals, at which point Populus took his sword and walked very slowly around him and drew a circle, and that says, fine, take as long as you want, but you have them come here and chit-chat about it because you're not leaving the circle until you make up your mind. What happened in the interim is that news passed to Israel that he had actually been killed by the Romans, and they threw a party. The problem was Antiochus showed up at his own funeral. And when he did, virtually all hell broke loose, which is at the point where he commits the abomination that causes desolation. 2 Maccabees 5, 15 through 21 has it take place after his second invasion. And 1 Maccabees 1:20 has it take place after his first. That is why we do not consider, one of the reasons why the books of Maccabees, though valuable, are not considered to be inspired. In any case, verse 31 refers to this act as the abomination that causes desolation. It is interesting, the ancient historian Pausanias, a Greek doctor, actually traces the whereabouts of several of the pieces of the temple. And everyone in the world is searching for the lost ark. The Jews say they have it today. But he says, interestingly, that everyone knew the temple curtain itself. Antiochus actually placed for years in the Zeus temple. And can you just imagine our God watching this take place? Like the Ark of the Covenant being taken to the temple of Dagon in the Samuel narratives. But about one thing, nothing is more certain than this, that after the day of Eleusis, his entire personality changed. I like to look at that in Judas Iscariot sometime. When was he changing? I like to do chronological character studies. I actually did one on Simon Peter. You know what I call it? The Life and Times of Simon Johnson. Is that great? Is that great or what? And then you can follow it up by the memoirs of Simon Johnson, 1st, 2nd Peter. You see, that'll bring them in. See, my problem is I get all these people, these new guys in the church, their wives drag them there, and we begin to talk about Adonijah and Absalom and Absalom, and I can just see them elbowing their wives and say, hey, remind me after this long service why I never come to church anyway. It's a hard thing for me, I'll tell you. This is the only place where I feel welcome. After this, the period by various Near Eastern authors of the day is referred to, this horrible period. One of them in the Zedekiah document calls it the era of anger. You can find it referenced to as the age of wrath, the ring of slaughter, the very great wrath upon Israel. Daniel calls it a time of trouble. There isn't any question but that they all point forward to what Jeremiah himself will call a time of Jacob's trouble. And by the way, that statement by Jeremiah in conjunction with what Daniel says in chapter 9, where the 77s are described by Gabriel as being a prophecy note for your people and your holy city. This is a very important verse in our interpretation of eschatology. I'm sure it'll be treated so. It's interesting, too, that though Antiochus reigned for over 11 years, the time of the great persecution that he pelted Israel with roughly lasted 3.5 years. I find very interesting. Section 5, the Gezerot, or the law that Antiochus' evil decrees leveled on Israel. Josephus says that after his destruction of the temple, it lay desolate for 3 years and 6 months, again the period of time suspiciously close to what is referred to in Scripture as the Great Tribulation. It was during this time that Antiochus evoked these evil decrees. First, he ordered Eleazar, an old priest, to eat swine flesh in front of people, and he killed him. 2 Maccabees chapter 5. Then he similarly killed 7 brothers, 2 Maccabees 7:1, in front of their mother, cutting their tongues out and then killing her. In another town, he gave the order for one of the old men to eat swine. And when the man started to do it, another man named Mattathias Maccabeus stepped up and killed him, and then turned around and killed the Seleucid officers that were there, which began what is called the Maccabean period or the Maccabean revolt. Antiochus began to take them seriously, and 6 months later he tried to relax some of these laws, but it didn't work, not with the Maccabeans. And so he turned around and pressed even harder, and he ordered the Jews to leave their sons uncircumcised, 2 Maccabees 1:48. He forbade them to acknowledge the Sabbath or any of the festivals, or maybe even more importantly, the evening and morning sacrifices. But this engendered retaliatory hatred in the lives of the Maccabean party all the more. Judas Maccabeus, verse 32b, he is called the Hammer, and he is there at 165. And I think at verse 32b, he represents the Maccabean party, who are the people who know their God and will firmly resist him. Even so, Daniel predicts that it was this time, while he began to deceive many with his flatteries, that is when Menelaus came to the temple, and he corrupted others, so that the people as a whole, with the Maccabeans, received a little help. By the way, do you see the phrase, those who instruct there, verse 33? It's interesting. I hope you have studied Qumran and the interpretation known as Pesher, because they took the scriptures to be pointing specifically to them, and they take this very verse in verse 33 and give their leader, the teacher of righteousness, this name from this particular verse. To this day, we have Purim to celebrate Israel's deliverance from Haman, and the Jewish people end up having Hanukkah because of what they consider to be the miraculous deliverance from Antiochus Epiphanes. I'm not sure if you know this or not. Surely you do. Did you know that Jesus attended Hanukkah festivals? Did you know it's in the Bible, in the Gospel of John? Every indication that he celebrated it. I think you should think on those things. If you study the progression of Israel and how they add things, like Jesus adding things to the end of the Passover meal, the Lord's table is an addendum to that. That is the nature of the movement and the heartbeat of the Jewish people. We need to get that. We need to feel it. We need to go to Israel. We need to identify with the land. I believe that the more sound our theological flow of understanding throughout the Bible is, that is what will help us get over some of the more esoteric verses and the things that we fight over with liberals. It's the flow of theology. Instead of arguing over a big G or a little G in the Gospel of John, just encourage them to read the whole Gospel of John and possibly come away assured that this man does not believe that Jesus is divine. Why argue over the... I say exegesis is very important, but it's the flow of theology, a comprehension of the theology that begins in the Old Testament in Genesis when God starts slowly coming out of the shadows and self-revealing himself to Adam and Eve and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and the people. Slowly, slowly. And even in the completion of the canon, he does it with us day by day. As you walk with the God like Paul, you are trying to get to know. How exciting is that? I've left my notes, our poor slide guy. I would say at the bottom of page 8, indeed, Jesus was relying upon the Jews of his day to remember the horrible Holocaust of the days of the Maccabeans when he stood in his Olivet Discourse and told them that they should pray that their flight out of the city would not be in winter or on the Sabbath, because this was a great problem for the Maccabeans. When Antiochus discovered they wouldn't fight on the Sabbath, well, that's a no-brainer. Let's just attack them on the Sabbath. I won't lose any men. We won't have to waste any bullets, you know. And the Maccabees thought maybe they ought to rethink this thing. See, Jesus, I think, is referring to that. By the way, look at this article I just found on Jesus' ministry of the Olivet Discourse by none other than S. Lewis John, or I think this one's by F.F. Bruce. Jesus was not himself an apocalyptist. Not even in the discourse which predicts the fall of the Jerusalem temple and attendant world convulsions on the eve of the coming of the Son of Man in the clouds with great power and glory. But it was the popular expectations that were generated by apocalyptic visions that provided the setting for much of his message, not just there, but throughout the Gospels. The new kingdom for which many of his hearers were so ardently looking and indeed drawn near, he assured them that the character of that kingdom and the conditions for sharing in it were quite different from what most of them had been taught to envision. I believe that because Genesis was Simon Peter's favorite book, he kept the copy of 1st and 2nd Enoch in his back pocket. I think Jesus was saying, you still have that thing? Get rid of it. What we see in the verses we have just studied then are characteristic in a historical character named Antiochus, who used religion as his servant. He manipulated his way with people. He aligns himself with a religious leader that he owns, and he makes or involves himself in a covenant that almost demonically gives people security, and then he suddenly breaks it in these and many others. So we come to this mysterious verse 40. I would argue that he starts talking about the Antichrist in verse 36, but the error, as the secularists see it, occurs in verse 40 with the way Antiochus is supposed to have died. Now, I would argue then that what you have here is this merging phenomenon that I talked about. I also believe it occurs at several points with the prophets. You see this sort of thing occurring throughout the Old Testament. In fact, I would just list a few here. This kind of thing is particularly recurrent in Isaiah. At chapter 7:14, he is predicting two different points of a rifle barrel. And this is the nature of prophecy, the near prophecy, the far prophecy. He's talking to Ahaz, and he starts talking about a virgin conceiving and having a child. Now, if you send those kind of Christmas cards out, and your neighbor comes over and says they were reading Isaiah 7:14, and they've discovered then that there were two virgin births. Do you know how to explain it? Because he's most certainly talking about the birth of a baby there for Ahaz to see. I would argue that in the first fulfillment of the prophecy, the emphasis is upon what's going to happen to kick Ahaz back on his heels as he watches the baby grow. So it's not in the nature of the birth, it's in what happens as the resultant of the birth. Whereas Matthew picks up on it and sees the end of the rifle barrel and talks about it as being the nature of the birth. We know that because in chapter 9, verse 6, Isaiah is looking at one person, namely the baby, and then looking at another where he talks about this son, this mysterious son, being a wonderful counselor, Almighty God, El Gibor, which two chapters later is the only term he ever uses for Almighty God. It's a very important verse to use or demonstration to demonstrate the deity of Jesus Christ. It doesn't happen there either. He, in chapter 28, and reverses the motif, and when he is talking about the king of Babylon, the pride in that man begins to cause Isaiah to look backward and look for none less than Lucifer in his fall. So he stops talking about the king of Babylon, and when he gets to this profound pride that we've seen in Nebuchadnezzar, he moves back to Satan himself. Ezekiel does the very same thing, along with Daniel as a sidekick in this deportation. And Ezekiel, in chapter 14, sees the same thing with the pride in the king of Tyre. And it doesn't stop there. It occurs actually also in the Messianic Psalms, particularly with David, who is walking in the Messiah's sandals. He's feeling Jesus will become the greater son of David, where David begins to speak in the Psalter of his own pain and persecution. And he goes at some points beyond his own pain. And he starts talking mysteriously about a pain of another who will walk one day in these sandals. He starts talking about his bones being out of joint and that sort of thing. I would argue that if you understand this merging technique, these things then are filled up in the latter personage. In fact, it is a recognition of this scriptural phenomenon, I think, that has led rabbis today to provide their insufficient interpretation of Isaiah 53, where they interpret themselves as the suffering servant. And they're not stupid. They know the technique. We are the ones that need to be able to differentiate in the technique. They see themselves as the suffering servant. But it is the same phenomenon that overcomes a Gentile, namely an Ethiopian, who happens to go to Jerusalem and pick up the book of Isaiah, and he has to ask Philip, who miraculously comes along, who in the world is this guy talking about? Is he talking about himself or another person? It's that merging phenomenon. Now, I'm going to leave out all my stuff on the dating, and it kills me to do this. I must tell you, listen, when S. Lewis Johnson ever speaks, I warn you, he will use Latin in his sermon. You know why? Because he struggled through Latin, and he's going to make it count. I told my wife once, it's coming, you watch for it. Well, I want you to know that I sat with Gleason Archer through Aramaic, and he is ruthless from 11 to 12. Then I ate lunch with him, and I know I bugged him. And then we had Septuagint together. Now, the men who knew me referred to what I was doing as a Protestant purgatory. And it was, in many ways, it was very hard, but I hung on to him. I wouldn't let him go. What is the phrase? I only passed this way once. How does that go? And I'm going to suck your brain dry before you get away. Well, that kind of thing with him. But I defer you to him because this guy reads and writes, 26 different languages? He had something like 16 different Bible studies in different languages every single day. We had a champion in him. We need to be raising up other champions. Would God, this Daniel Davies, isn't he something? Yeah. You know, wouldn't it be great if we had like 6 or 7 Daniels in our midst that could be Gleason Archer and come here or be Daniel Davies? Wouldn't it be cool? We just call all Daniels. Wouldn't it be cool? Wouldn't that be an incentive to our young people that are going to be here? This is another Daniel, and we got another Daniel in the wings and such. Well, it's just a thought. He is referred to in every way in the New Testament. Paul warns his churches about that sort of thing in the coming one in 2 Thessalonians 2, 9 through 12, the one who will coerce people into believing a lie. Let me tell you, I think that the real enemy, as we look back here, and I tried to do an analysis of this chapter, I really think the real enemy was Hellenism. When I go to Israel and we lead tours, we try to discuss every site from an archaeological point of view, then a sociological point of view, and then a theological point of view. And there is a synagogue in Tiberias. Now, there's no reference to Jesus ever going there. There was a great cemetery there. Herod has a castle there, or a fortress there and all. But I want you to look. This is one of the floors of the synagogue. And look at the second slide here. This is the zodiac, friends. And do you see that? You know who that is? That's the twins Gemini. They're Gentiles. They're uncircumcised. Now, it was nice of them to put a diaper on them. See? But I asked the people, how do you find a people who are the most stringent observers of their God, who were willing to die rather than let Pilate put the shields of Caesar in the streets of Jerusalem? How is it these people are now going to be able to put tiles in the synagogue floor where they're worshiping that present the pagan zodiac? And it happens because of the same way Antiochus was able to find a high priest that he could sell the job to with a Gentile named Jason, and then find another one when he drops dead. It's interesting to note, important to note, that Hellenism at first was not forced on the Jews. They openly embraced it. There was an assimilation taking place, and if we do not think there's a syncretistic assimilation taking place in the world today, our world, and taking members from our church to do it. When I first went to Silvis, we had a little boy die, and I asked one of the ladies in my church, I still didn't even know everybody, I said, he was going to another nearby church. I said, was he a Christian? She said, oh yeah, he's been an altar boy for several years. See, he really wasn't a member of our church, he was in Awana, but it's what the mother said that struck me. I said, man, do I have my work cut out here? Antiochus sought from the beginning to bring Hellenism to the east, which is exactly what Alexander had done, and he had done it ever so successfully. Most people don't realize that because of his father, Antiochus III the Great, Antiochus IV was actually a prisoner of war and grew up in Greece, and so we would expect him to be able to have this kind of thing. Alexander is the one that planted the seed. Antiochus came along and watered it. But it was the Jewish people who embraced the elegance and the sophistication of the Greek culture. They didn't just embrace it. They were enamored by it. And again, that is nothing less than the syncretism we see going on today. He had the games brought in, and people think, well, what's so wrong with exercising? Not so much wrong with it, but they had to do it in the nude. The only thing the Jewish boys wore were oiling themselves. They were so ashamed of their circumcision, they tried to reverse it, and many of them were successful. And they did all of this nakedness within the sight of the Temple Mount. Now, I don't know much about Kung Fu and the martial arts, but I'm a little afraid of it because of its affiliation with the gods that are associated with it. So I'm a little off my bounds. You don't have to take what I recommend. I'm just throwing that out to you. But I'm saying that with the Greek culture, the gymnasium went far more than just a place to exercise. And by the way, I think this is the same reason you have the name Balaam popping up in the real apocalypse at the end of the canon. Because that is how Balaam ultimately thought Israel could be overcome, through that kind of syncretism. If we were to relate this to our day, and I need to be very careful of how I say this, please do not misunderstand it. I think Israel is still going to be the football field in the day ahead. Now, the reasons may change. It may be because of oil. They didn't much care, those bad boys, about oil back then. But oil may be a kicker. But if you look around at our day, people seem to vote and are being led in political arenas by panic, whether it's money or leaders. We have a lady coming to the Supreme Court justice system who has no experience as a judge. We have gone away from what I would call some kind of historic sanity, so that the emergencies that can happen in life, whether they're Katrina or oil spill, has no real bearing on the president's capacity to stop or start these things. It's the panic of the people that I watch. Put your finger on the pulse of the community in which you live, so that people abandon otherwise normal ways of thinking and voting and electing. And we see it happening all over in Europe today. So I think the economy can tell us that we better hold on to this. Now, I'm going to have a word just to say about it. I got 15 minutes. I'm like in my glory because I think I'm going to finish here. I want to stop for a minute to talk about the sovereignty of God. It has always been so. Please don't think that I'm saying that because apocalyptic is a new genre and features it, that it wasn't featured in the Bible. It was. But you certainly see how it's on every page in Daniel. It's almost in every seven verses or something. I mean, it is majorly emphasized. God is the Lord of history. He changes times and seasons, and make no mistake, he sets up kings and he deposes them, says Daniel. I believe that churches and countries get the person they deserve. I think it works like that. I think that's the way it works. The Most High rules the kingdom of men, 425. Did you know that the Most High, and whoever it was speaking on chapter 4 the other night pointed this out admirably, did you know that that term occurs 6 times in that one chapter, more than any other place in the entire Bible in a concentrated time? Now I want to talk about what John Greening brought up in Daniel, which is a major focus of this book, and is treated here, I think, in chapter 11, and that is theodicy, the way in which a sovereign Lord is expected to deal with those things and those people who don't follow him, including you. Please remember with me that when Abraham in chapter 18 balked with God at the thought that God would destroy Sodom if he had a beloved saved Baptist in the group. That's what Abraham, he kept thinking he had something over on God. Now he started high, he was forced to go down low, but then he makes this statement, surely the God of righteousness will do the right thing. Well, yeah. Wouldn't you think? Wouldn't we have started that way? What does Abraham mean by that? See, what he means by that, and we are all of us whittling a God in our brains that we serve. I'm going to tell you that right now. We are. We have to chip things off in our brain, our understanding of him as we grow. We have to always be disciples. But that world out there has an image of God that they've whittled in their brain, and that God better jump through their hoops or they're not going back to church again. So as God is slowly self-revealing himself, he has this dialogue with Abraham. Now what he could have done to Abraham is lambast him, which is what he does to Job at the end of his book. You remember? When he gets done with Job, what does Job say? Where were you, Job, when I created? Where were you, Job, when the angels? You know about them, Job? And Job ends up saying, shut my mouth, Lord. Why doesn't he do that to Abraham? Same era, roughly. He allows Abraham to go as God acquiesces to his request, but not answering his question. Because the fact of the matter is, God does attack countries where his own people are killed, and we have that coming out in the wonderful statement of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. What do they say? That's very important. They say, God is able. And I have to tell you, that phrase occurs everywhere. I was going to have you sing, he is able more. If you're going to preach that, I would think that would be a great chorus. I love the choruses we're singing. That's a good one, though. Occurs more time in that Bible than everywhere. He's able to do it. We have no doubt about that. But whether he wants to do it or not, in our case, even though we're dressed here with all our combustibles, we're going in there. It's up to him to do whatever he wants to do. So yeah, Abraham's question is answered over and over again, even though God doesn't do it for him that day, which is why he doesn't sometimes answer your prayer overnight. Makes you commiserate for a while with him. He says in Isaiah, Assyria, who's coming to punish my people, is my rod. Think about that, when they used to throw the pregnant women up and sword them like shish kebab. Habakkuk takes his stand in the watchtower and he won't give up. God, look at the sin of your people. Aren't you coming? Aren't you coming? Aren't you coming? And God makes him too wait and wait and wait. And he says, don't worry about it. Habakkuk, I'm taking care of it. And he says, shh, thank you, God. And he says, how are you going to do it? He says, I'm bringing the Babylonians. And Habakkuk says, the Babylonians? I would start Daniel, by the way. I know we don't have the time. But I would have started Daniel with Habakkuk if I were preaching it, and I have. I called it the Habakkuk Files. The antecedent of the pain in Daniel. Over and over again, if you go to the end of the book, you find the phrase, it was given to him. God gave to the Antichrist the power to do what he did. So God is sovereign even over evil. And we can learn that in the first book of the Bible. You don't even have to get to the end of Genesis, where Joseph says to his brothers, I'm not going to kill you. Now that Dad's dead, you're going to get me. No, I understand the evil in your heart. What you did to me was evil. But God meant it all, everything, me throwing into the spittoon and all of that kind of thing. It gets worse, this theodicy thing, if you're going to hang on with me. I always say to our people, discipleship is like a terrier dog in the kitchen, and you come home from work and you let the dog grab hold of the dishcloth and you sling him back and forth on the tiles, and he loves it. And then you sling him right into the refrigerator. And then you sling him into the dishwasher. And a few more times, this dog's eyes have changed. He's still got his teeth in the rag, but at first he said, I can play this game all day with you, pal. I love it. I've been waiting for you to come home. And then suddenly the dog says in his eyes, I love this game. I don't know what you're doing here, but if you keep hitting me on the refrigerator and the stove, I might have to let go. Discipleship is not letting go by the grace of God, but you can't do it on your own. And you can't do it out of gratitude for what he did for you. Gratitude was never meant to deliver that way. You only do it through future grace. You're only going to live out any of this tomorrow by the same grace you got saved with 20 years ago. That was free. I had to tell you that because it gets worse. Bathsheba was used by God. Do you understand that? Without Bathsheba, you don't have Solomon, who was good at first. Without Bathsheba, you don't have Psalm 51. It gets worse. Without Judas, you don't have a Good Friday. You ever imagine telling people that we're going to call this Good Friday while Jesus is up there hanging like a scarecrow? Yeah, we're going to call this Good Friday. When Martin Luther saw all of this, he sat back in his chair, and I know you know he said this. He looked out into outer space and he said, "Even the devil is God's devil." Daniel saw it clearly by his repetition of the phrase, "in the appointed time." I remember years ago Don Carson saying, and this is not something you'd want to use probably at a funeral, but you better get it said. He said if a little boy was in class and he said to the little boy, "How do you have blue eyes? Your parents both have brown eyes." The little boy coming straight from Sunday school would say, "God." Would that be all right with you? God gave him blue eyes. When that little boy grows up to be a science teacher, and somebody asks him why he has blue eyes, you know what he'd say as a science teacher? "Well, my parents both had brown eyes, but they both contributed one recessive gene. I got them both, and I have blue eyes." Would that be true? Yeah, it would be true. Which would be truer? What he said when he was a boy or what he said as a science teacher? What if you asked the student of theology, why did the Assyrians attack Israel to begin with? And the answer is, man, they're ruthless people. They invaded people. That's what they were into. Would that be true? What about if I said God? Would that be true? So when you come to a funeral, Don Carson said, and somebody has died prematurely from our vantage point, and you say, "How did they die?" "Well, my wife was killed by a drunken driver." "What happened?" "Well, he was drunk and he drove across the lane and hit her." Would that be true? Be on the accident report. What if somebody said God? Would that be true? E.B. Hill, in his wife's funeral, he said, "I was leaning on Lovey all my life." He said, "God came to me and said, 'I know you have. Now I want you to lean on me a while.'" There's a purpose in it. When I was away teaching one time, I called Harriet. When I got in, she was crying. She said, "Steve, our little boy Johnny somehow heard about the Holocaust, and we were sitting at the table, and he wanted me to explain it to him." I said, "Well, did you?" She goes, "Yeah, I felt he did. I felt I needed to." I said, "What did he say?" She said, "When I was finished at the end, he looked across the room. Nobody was there. And he said, 'God must have had a plan.'" He's in college now, and I got to tell him, I threw his quote up on the screen here at the national conference. Is that something that a little 7-year-old boy could say that? You think God was glorified? I think he was. I think that's what has got to be coming out of our young children's mouth. So the question, why does God allow evil? Why will he bring the Antichrist on the scene? I came across an article that said, "Don't waste your cancer." Oh yeah, you got to get this article. The article asks the question, do you think a sovereign God doesn't happen to notice that you've got a few cells that are starting to mutate? You think he can't watch that? Do you think he just allows it to happen? Or could he not have a purpose in it all? If he has a purpose in it, then don't waste your cancer. As it relates to Johnny's statement, "Why the Holocaust, Mom?" and his presumption that God must have had a plan, I was reading "These Things That Are Hard to Swallow" by Jacob Bernard August, a Jew. He writes, "The state of Israel," let's put it on the screen here. Yeah, "the present state of Israel would not have taken its present form were it not for the external pressures of the Nazis." You think about that. Sure, God can get anything done any way he wants to, But it's interesting the ways he chooses to do it. See, I look back at Daniel and Moses, Ezekiel. Where do these guys come from? In the area, in the era and the period in which they live. Well, yeah, Moses had his parents to nurture him. Did Daniel? Do we assume that he did? I don't know. I think he would have. Ezekiel, Jeremiah talks about himself separated from his mother's womb like Paul. I think that the church goes the way it goes with the men. I think men need to raise their sons in a way so that when they die, a year, 2 years, 10 years later, and the sons are talking, the sons will say to each other, I know what Dad would say about this. That's how you ought to raise your kids. In fact, you ought to do it better than that. You ought to raise them so well so that they just eclipse you altogether. And when they have that dilemma, they say, I know what God would say. You don't even need to be in the picture. That's what I love what Dan Davies said. It's not about us. When I go overseas and teach, I've had the privilege of telling Walt Kaiser before he croaks, Gleason Archer's dead now. But I have the unusual feeling on the plane that it's not even Steve Lovelady that's going to teach. I feel like nothing more than the paper boy that delivers the news. Because I'm not really creative. I'm not even all that bright. You have to study and study and study, and even then you can make mistakes. And God help me, I've had everybody praying here. I said so much, surely there's got to be one somewhere. Like Moses Maimonides, before he died, he went in and screwed around with his writing so all his disciples couldn't trust him. He said, I'm not studying this hard for all of you. You've got to find your errors yourself and get them out. Now, I'm not so prideful as that, but I hope I haven't made an error here. I will tell you this, which ought to rebuke us as pastors. Abraham Heschel is a Hebrew scholar, not a believer at all, and he won't even talk about a tractate until he memorizes the entire thing in Hebrew. Now, never mind that he speaks Hebrew. How many of us memorize the entire book of Daniel? You know what I'm saying? We need to be rebuked. We need to be urged on. We need to have deacons who understand the times, like the tribe of Issachar. Jesus said, even in the Olivet Discourse, that we need to be aware of the times. We can't predict the day. But we need to put the pulse on our community and our world and alert people, because one of the things Jesus said is that even the elect are going to have lazy eyes in the last days. In Silvas, Harriet, my wife, is an English teacher, and she teaches, I don't know what they call them, but they're not college type, general ed, I guess, is what it is. She takes it as a burden to teach them how to think. How to think. That's the problem. Hosea said, my people perish for lack of knowledge. He might as well have said, the think. Did you know that lawlessness is really Torah-lessness? It's really what it is. The Torah's the pointer. It's the foundation. It's interesting to me that in these captivities, 400 years of Egypt, when God comes back and starts doing something, miracles happen. And I believe with all of my heart that the miracles are not so much evangelistic as they are to call his own people back and get them to remember the God of their fathers. I had a girl die in my church. She had the same birthday as me, September 18th. It was tragic. She went to my old alma mater in Grand Rapids, and the night before she popped her head in my office and said, Pastor, I'm going back to Grand Rapids. I'll give them your best. I said, I'll see you when you get back, Rhonda. She drove 7 miles and a truck hit her, and I was doing her funeral the next Friday. Could hardly bear it. And I said to the people in the congregation, I should be doing her wedding here. She's only 18. But I said, I must be able to tell you that on the basis of the Word of God, she lived a full life. And the only way I could say that is because of this next verse. It says, my times are in your hands. All the days ordained for me were in your book before one of them came to be. Isn't that the conclusion Job comes to? Another early book. The Lord gave. And it's not Satan that takes away. Yeah, you have this interchange in chapter 1. You touch his body. No, you touch him. You touch him. Ultimately, God is the sovereign one. This isn't some kind of Near Eastern Zoroastrianism where Batman and Robin and we wake up the next day to see who wins. It isn't that kind of a thing. I was stopped the other day, Harriet travels out to see her kids. I'm really wrapping this up, I promise, but this is the last stuff that's good stuff. She's out in Colorado. I hate grocery shopping. You guys ever do that? I feel like a duck out of water down there doing it. And of all things, I ran into one of my son's old friends named Tully. The guy's a little herky-jerky. He's going to a charismatic church. He worries me a little bit. But he says, Pastor Lovelady. He talks a little herky-jerky. And I says, yeah, Tully, good to see you. He says, oh, I said, are you okay, Tully? He says, oh, couldn't be better. He said, I got to ask you a question. He said, you'll know the answer. I said, okay, ask away, Tully. He says, is it wrong to just want to go to heaven and leave all this? I said, the grocery store? He doesn't know everything else. I said, Tully, you got a girlfriend? Yeah, I do. I said, you having problems? He goes, yeah. I said, I thought you might be. I said, well, Tully, I don't think there's any reason to be burdened about wanting to go to heaven, but it's not the best reason because you want to check out here. I said, really, we ought to want to go to be with God, isn't that right? I said, Paul seems to have this problem in Philippians 1, but he determines that he's going to let God be sovereign even in that. Sure, he'd like to go to heaven, but he's convinced that if he stays around, he'll be good for what happens. I'll tell you, you might not like me saying this, I've risked everything already. What are you going to do, not have me again? If we are right in our eschatology, if we are right about our interpretation, because some of us have got to be wrong, right? There's so many different positions. If we are right, the advantageous thing may not be that we will escape pain. The advantageous thing may be that we will not be shown to pass the test. My people perish for lack of knowledge. I hear that the shack is being taught in Sunday school classes in our area in Baptist churches. I have to tell you, folks, something is wrong. And I hated to read the book. I read it coming back from the Philippines, and I cried all the way through it. And I'm not so sure that I didn't cry because of the way he brought me into the text over the death of his granddaughter or his daughter. But let me tell you something. Don Carson was teaching for Tyndale years ago, and he lectured, and they have you come over and eat at people's homes, you know? And while he's eating, he had been talking about imaging. See, open theism is a big deal. A book's written about it. I think one of the greatest combatants against open theism is the understanding of the sovereignty of God in apocalyptic literature. Daniel 11 would be a big rebuttal for open theism, although you need to read the books and get engaged. But the guy said to Don Carson, and Don Carson had talked about imaging, the emergent church, imaging, the ability to rethink everything and distrust all authority. And the guy said to him, he said, Dr. Carson, he said, I was a horrible Christian. He said, I had a terrible distrust of God as my father. He said, but when I went to the imaging class, they had me picture my wife, my mother giving birth to me on the table, and Jesus was delivering me. And he said, he cleaned me up and he loved me. And he said, now I can love people. He said, it got me over the hurdle. He said, I'm an effective Christian. He said, you wouldn't take that away from me, would you? Now, how do you answer that while you're eating the guy's wife's cooking at the table and that? You know what I mean? Guy was probably crying. He said to him, look, if you're walking with God now and everything's restored for you, he said, I'm happy for you. He said, but the way you went about it was illegitimate. And he said, I'll tell you the danger of that. You didn't trust the living God and his spirit that led the writings of it to get you there. You trusted this guy. And he said, consequently, if you fall again, something happens to you. Do you know where you're going to go? You're not going to go back to this guy. You're going to go to that guy. Turns out that the author of The Shack also was child abused at home. Little wonder then that he writes a book about God being an old woman, a grandma, and the Holy Spirit having a Hindu name. And he merges it all in. At the end, I should have been crying about Americans through syncretism, like those floors in the synagogue, and that's the lesson we try to teach when they stand there looking at the tile. It's happening to us. The shack being taught in a Sunday school class in a Baptist church is absolutely, to the living God who has the proper perspective, no different than the tiles in the floor. In our church, I take the scientific term parallax, which means that if you change looking at the stars from a different perspective, you can understand a little more. That's what our people need to do. They need to get a new look at God a parallax. And they're going to do it only through legitimate, exegetical, relevant sermons, and you can't get it done in 15 minutes. I can't even get it done in an hour and five, for crying out loud. But I'm a dinosaur, and I'm headed out. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we come to you, God, and we cannot help to go back to what we were taught, even as disciples listening to you pray. You taught us to pray, join with me. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread, and forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Blessed be his name. And all God's people said, thank you, you're dismissed. Finally.